Right, I want to talk today about the contribution to utility as something distinct from, more specific than, the contribution to use value. So what kind of argument can we make for the humanities that goes by way of a claim that they help us to recognise, define, and perhaps in limited ways even quantify a contribution to individual or collective happiness? Now, one of you called me, I think, in the first lecture in this series on my suspicion that this is among the least trusted lines for the humanities defence at the moment. You may be right, but I'm pretty sure I'm right when I say that it is among the least developed of those arguments. So it's not one that I think we turn to in any depth, though I think we do probably fairly often gesture towards the idea that a richer life may be had that is educated in culture and the goods of culture. So there are certain difficulties to start with, even though the notion of the contribution to happiness as a means of defending public goods has been very current in recent years, so advanced by David Cameron, our Prime Minister, and very widely pursued by economists and behavioural psychologists, behavioural economists as well. It's not one that's really made it into the literature on the defence of higher education as a public good, and it's certainly not one that's made it more specifically into the defence of the humanities. There are problems, of course, definitional ones. As Socrates famously put it, happiness is a many, not a one. So exactly what you're talking about when you talk about a contribution to happiness is immediately up for debate. But having conceded that much, we do have one very famous formulation of the argument for happiness in the writings of John Stuart Mill. It's specific in the first instance to poetry, and its status as a defence is at one remove. In other words, he doesn't put it forward as a defence of the humanities, but it offers grounds on which others can use it to that purpose. It's not in the first instance polemical. Instead, it comes pretty strongly out of his own experience, an experience that is far from representative. But it's a defence that has been used in the past and effectively, I think, to argue against any kind of reductively analytic education and more broadly against any version of the public culture which stresses too much a reductive economic and political conception of the good. And in principle, it doesn't just attach to poetry but to all cultural enterprises that feed the imagination, so history, philosophy, but also any sort of richly conceived humanistic notion of any discipline at all. Now, I'm going to take you through in three components, really, Mill's own experience, the way in which it led him to rethink his theory of the good and how we pursue the good, and specifically how we pursue a notion of happiness that might connect up individual motivation towards happiness with a notion of the happiness as a contribution to the public good. And then I want to speak specifically at the end about the component that is less easy maybe to make work for us now, and that is Mill's definition of qualitative pleasures. So a distinction in the quality of our pleasures that operates for him largely intellectually, of course. Now, I'm going to start by saying that there was for me a very big surprise when I started doing the reading for this lecture, when I started reading up on the material coming out of economics, behavioural economics, because I expected that this would be material that's being well worked there, and I found it extraordinarily absent. So I have, of course, some embarrassment in seeming to be rude to my colleagues in economics and behavioural economics specifically. But if you look at their literature, it is astonishingly written at the moment, it seems to me, in ignorance of its own history. And it's not actually difficult to find economists who will agree with that statement, so perhaps I don't need to be as embarrassed as I'm inclined to be. There is a standard observation in the literature that there's a correlation between individuals being at the top of the income and economic distribution and they're reporting higher levels of happiness, although that literature routinely fails to make any distinction between the effects of the education and the effects of the prosperity that education has brought you, so that's a problem to start with. It also routinely observes that there is a relation between that the relation between happiness and education is reciprocal. So education affects a person's happiness, but happiness also affects the ability to learn. Economic theorists commonly describe education as an important support for building incomes, improving health, creating trust, and increasing the efficiency and accountability of government. Some of them have detailed more specific ways in which it can alter behaviour, including increasing the propensity of people to engage in civic responsibilities. Indeed, the World Happiness Report, the first one commissioned last year for the United Nations, claims that it's primarily through those important behavioural channels that education supports happier lives. there's a little bit of acknowledgement of the specific contributions that it can make to knowledge of the kind that helps you form values conducive to a better society, but not very much. And if you go into the statistics, the negative correlations are much more impressive than the positive ones. So 74% of deeply happy people have some exposure to formal education, allegedly, but 90% of unhappy people have none. A statistic to go home and think about. Almost nothing is said about the nature and means of the contribution education may make. Okay, so the correlations proposed, but there's almost, that I can find, almost no explanatory work of how and why it's doing that. And I can find nothing that makes more specific claims about the field of education. In fact, the efficiency with which the World Happiness Report dispatches any complications seems to me quite surprising. So this is the arrogance of the humanist looking at chicken works and finding and wanting. Have a look at the first one on the top of the sheet. One obvious problem is that happy people may be more likely to persist in education, and this effect cannot be controlled for in panel studies. Education may have some non-income benefits to the individuals who get an education, especially in poor countries, but this is smaller than is often claimed by educationalists. On top of that, there may be important social effects through an informed electorate and in poor countries through reduced birth rates and mortality. End of analysis. And if you try to go deeper, you're told that the data for higher education is simply not strong enough to tell us anything reliable. Okay, so with all my qualms about seeming to beat up another field, I can't really see much of a way around the embarrassment. The most astonishing thing for me was the almost complete absence, apart from one reference in John Kay and one in a book that's come out more recently, also a trade book, a very passing reference to John Stuart Mill, that, in the case of John Kay, a quotation about the indirectness of happiness that I will in fact come to later in the lecture, but he is an honourable exception. Okay, so let's try to do the work for them. So John Stuart Mill describes famously in his autobiography, published posthumously in 1873, how reading certain works of literature rescued him from the narrow ends-driven conception of happiness that had been drilled into him by his homeschooling in utilitarian education. In 1826, he was 20 years of age and the product of an experiment in homeschooling that has since become notorious in Isaiah Berlin's lovely phrase, an appalling success. Under the tutelage of his father, James Mill, so that's the political philosopher and dedicated Benthamite, he was raised in a radical school of reformist political thought and activism. He tells us that he studied ancient Greek from the age of three. The moment you have a three-year-old, you start to wonder. By his early teenage years, he was a fluent reader of Latin, Greek, French, and proficient in many branches of the classics, philosophy, law, history, economics. So when he's 15, his father decided he shouldn't go to Cambridge, on the probably correct grounds that he already knew more than he could possibly learn there. And he instead began a long and distinguished career in his father's department of the India Office. By 1826, he's shouldering considerable responsibilities there, but he's also overseeing the education of his eight siblings at home. He's studying, he's editing, he's taking a leading role in the debates of his radical circle, and he's propagandizing zealously as a periodical writer for the Benthamite cause, so he's pretty stretched. One would have thought. Then in the autumn of that year, he experiences a crisis in my mental history, and this is the very famous passage from the autobiography. It occurred to me to put the question directly to myself. Suppose that all your objects in life were realized, that all the changes in institutions and opinions which you're looking forward to could be completely affected at this very instant. Would this be a great joy and happiness to you? And an irrepressible self-consciousness distinctly answered, no. At this, my heart sank within me. The whole foundation on which my life was constructed fell down. I frequently asked myself if I could or if I was bound to go on living when life must be passed in this manner. I generally answered to myself that I did not think I could possibly bear it beyond a year. When, however, not more than half that duration of time elapsed, a small ray of light broke in upon my gloom. I was reading, accidentally, Marmontel's memoirs and came to the passage which relates his father's death, the distressed position of the family, and the sudden inspiration by which he, then a mere boy, felt and made them feel that he would be everything to them, would supply the place of all that they had lost. A vivid conception of the scene and its feelings came over me, and I was moved to tears. From this moment, my burden grew lighter. The oppression of the thought that all feeling was dead within me was gone. I was no longer hopeless. I was not a stock or a stone. I had still, it seemed, some material out of which all worth of character and all capacity for happiness are made. Now, the critical literature on Mill standardly recognises several aspects to the intellectual repositioning of himself that followed in the 1830s and 40s. First, it led him to think really hard about psychological determinism and free will, to put that more plainly, to work hard to retrieve a serious conception of free will from his empiricist psychological theory that he'd been educated in. Secondly, it led him to make a series of important philosophical revisions to his account of utilitarianism so that he could incorporate a more complex theory of human motivations and redescribe what the individual's proper relation ought to be to the goal of happiness. Those revisions are primarily, but not exclusively, the business of the classic essay on utilitarianism, which I'll spend some time on. That essay also introduces the famous distinction between quantitative and qualitative pleasure, by way of a challenge to Bentham's strictly quantitative approach. Prejudice apart, Bentham wrote another famous line, "The game of pushpin is of equal value with the arts and sciences of music and poetry." If the game of pushpin furnish more pleasure, it is more valuable than either. Or, as Mill put it more tersely, pushpin is as good as poetry. Higher pleasures in Mill's revisionary account tend to be those pleasures available to a being of higher faculties. They involve intellectual tastes. Utilitarianism says very little about the content of them. The only pursuits directly implicated are poetry and philosophy. But the belief that some pleasures are non-instrumentally better than others colours a lot of Mill's post-crisis thinking about what a more persuasive account of happiness than Bentham's and any adequate model of education will need to comprehend. So let me go through them one by one. First, the crisis itself. Then the revised account of utilitarianism, of the motive towards pleasure, and then the qualitative issue. Now, the first thing to say, really, I think, about that crisis, that document of crisis, is just how very odd Mill's response is. For one thing, his emphatic no is logically stronger than is warranted by the situation. Maybe you would be happy. You can't be sure. It's in the future. But the reply he gives is firmer than logic alone would justify. It's too emphatic, and it recognises, I think, something deeper than a problem of offended egoism. It's a level of distress that goes beyond the ordinary coordinates of a loss of political faith. Okay, so something's happening there that is plainly excessive. Now, the difficulty for him on all fronts wasn't simply that utilitarianism offered no guarantee of happiness in his individual case. It's a very familiar objection to utilitarianism. It's one that Mill himself helped to make familiar, that it computes happiness in the aggregate. It just adds it up. The greatest happiness is just the sum of all the individual happinesses. But Mill's problem was not just the lack of regard for his own agency. In giving him no reasons to care for his own happiness as an element in that bigger picture, Benthamism left him confronting the lack of any secure connection between the individual's immediate motive, his or her, my own happiness, and the espoused goal of utilitarianism, which is the general happiness, okay, if you like, the public good version of happiness. And the general happiness really mattered to Mill. He wanted to want it. The problem for him was that he had ceased to want it. One striking feature of the mental crisis and the route he finds out of it is that you would think the simplest result of it would be that he would just part company with Benthamism. He would think, actually, utilitarianism has not done what it was supposed to do for me. Instead, what he does is really spend the rest of his career trying to figure out a revised version of utilitarianism that will allow the greatest happiness not to be the price paid for the happiness of the individual, okay, to make these two things really work together. Now, the way in which he reacts is really odd, and the best description I've found of the oddness is from the philosopher Elijah Milgram. I've given you the reference at the bottom of your sheets. It's an essay called Mill's Incubus in a collection called John Stuart Mill and the Art of Life. He draws out just how peculiar the predicament was. The problem wasn't simply that Mill was depressed. If his affliction had only been clinical depression, it would not have been nearly as bad as it was, and it wouldn't have shaped Mill's life and philosophizing as it did. The deeper problem was that although he was depressed and unmotivated, he couldn't act depressed. People who are depressed mope around, can't get out of bed in the morning, and give up on the enterprises for which they have no heart. If Mill had been able to do any of this, he wouldn't have been as desperate as he was. Instead, having realized that he simply didn't care about his party's platform, he couldn't cease working to advance it. The pace of his labours didn't slow perceptibly, and hardly any of his acquaintances seemed even to have realised that anything was wrong. So, as Milgram describes Mill's case, in line with Mill's own understanding of psychology, the problem was the sudden perception of a gap between commitment to the goal defined by him by his utilitarian education and his ability to associate desire with that goal. A convinced empiricist like his father, Mill believed that the psyche was, at the time of your birth, the Lockean blank slate, basically, onto which are etched by repeated experience pathways or habitual associations of sensation and perception. In the main, the effort of all his early education had been to form the strongest possible associations of pleasure with all things beneficial to the great whole, and of pain with all things hurtful to it. His whole personality had been structured around that overriding objection. But because the associations had been forcibly instilled using what he called the old familiar instruments, praise and blame, reward and punishment, the feelings they produced were too weak to withstand the early inaugurated habit of analysis, which then became a dissolving force, as Mill puts it, a perpetual worm at their root. So you have a double problem, if you like, and I'm not going to take you too deeply into the associationist psychology that explains it, but give you, if you like, just the summary version. A pleasurable association that becomes merely habitual will weaken over time, okay? It will just fade away. But in Mill's case, pleasure is also vulnerable to the entrenched habit of skeptical scrutiny. So if you've got a kind of double problem, if you like, that is just going to fade away, but it's also going to be actively eroded. A mind unsupported by the analytic habit would be without intellectual metal, but one that's trained to employ it too exclusively is going to be in danger of believing in and caring for no sustained purposes. It's just going to exhibit a merely mechanical competence, however impressive, and that is really Mill's assessment of where he'd got to by 20. Very good mechanically, but precocious and premature, and it's not really fed by a serious emotional and motivational life behind it, if you like. So the core of the crisis in 1826-7, and if Milgram is correct, and I think he is, the origin of Mill's abiding concern thereafter with liberty of mind, intellectual affiliation, being able to exert your own moral choices, being able to find and follow your own desires, really comes out of this crisis, the sense that that's the thing that's missing in his own relation to the things that he ostensibly should care about most. Right, so what does he do? Well, he doesn't really do anything. He gets lucky and he happens upon a copy of Jean-Francois Marmontel. And to me, I haven't seen anybody really speak about this. To me, it seems really interesting, actually, that it isn't a matter of choice, that you don't go to the bookshelf and you think, what might help me out of this moment of crisis? It's just fortuitous. And he remarks upon the fortuity, the accidental picking of it up. What is it? It's not a work of high literature. It's a work of sentimental recollection, didactic instruction for children, and a bit of a mix of social and literary history. Very popular in its own time, 18th century French. One of its main Victorian admirers alongside John Stuart Mill was Ruskin. What does that tell us? You know, another overachieving son with a complicated bit of emotional baggage to take from childhood into adulthood, from family life. Okay, now, he likes the Wordsworthian, if you like, fortuity of just happening upon it. It's not hard to see why the particular scene that's picked out did the work that it did. There's quite a lot of psychoanalytically inspired literature on it. I think, and the best of it, Bruce Maslich's book, James and John Stuart Mill, Father and Son in the 19th Century. Okay, so he reads the coming of age scene at the news of the father's death. Unsurprisingly, it's often read as an unconscious wish fulfillment scene, imaginative gratification of the desire to murder the father. Mill's point of identification in the story is with the mere boy who convinces his family that he can be everything to them. His making them feel prompts the feelings in Mill that then reassure him all feeling is not dead. The significance for Mill of the tears shed over Marmontel is that they're a much needed reassurance that he has that capacity for feeling, an irrepressible self-consciousness that hasn't been wholly absorbed into the utilitarian pursuit of the greatest happiness. So his response to literature initiates the discovery of new motivations for agency, the motivation to achieve some worth of character, and the conscious desire to realize some capacity for personal happiness. Right, so he's not saying anything so crude, you wouldn't expect it really, would you, as literature makes us happy. Nor is he saying with vague romantic flourish that feeling trumps reason. In fact, he's saying pretty much the opposite, at least of the first of those. In his own case, happening upon a sympathetically engaging piece of literature at a critical moment in his life opened him up to the experience of unhappiness. It gave him, if you like, a kind of occasion and a prompt to knowing and expressing just how deeply unhappy he was. Grief, distress, these are the feelings, and also inspiration that come out of it. Determination, presumably. Love, presumably, as well, but also surely the ambition to be equal to the task of replacing his father. And the fact that he can feel and express that complex of emotions, distress, grief, but something more as well, is what proves to him, though at this point secondarily, that he has natural powers of sympathy
a capacity to feel for and like other people. Now, the secondary bit, the sympathetic kinship with others, is in the larger picture, I think, at least as important as the primary recognition of his capacity to feel deeply. If you want to use this material to try to think about, as I do clearly, about what the contribution of the humanities to happiness might be, I think you have to deal with an initial problem, which is that John Stuart Mill's is an entirely unrepresentative case. It's just weird. Nobody else, as far as I can think of, and I'd tell me if you can, has been quite so badly deformed by the early years in a way that would make the rescue through literature operative as a general model. In a more normal education, the cultivation of feelings would have happened through numerous channels, starting with the daily affective life of family and friendships. It wouldn't have required the special cultivation of feeling assisted by literature to act as a strong corrective. But that said, Mill repeatedly tells us that although his own case was extreme, it was indicative of a general intellectual limitation within classic utilitarianism. He wasn't just the son of one man who undervalued feeling and carried that undervaluation into a pretty exacting educational program for his small son. He was also associated with an intellectual group and an intellectual enterprise that was theoretically indifferent to poetry and to imagination generally as an element of human nature. Of Bentham himself, Mill notes that he used to say all poetry is misrepresentation, but then he goes on to say quite what he thinks Bentham means by that. The failing of poetry and of all impressive speech was specifically a failure with respect to reason. So insofar as the Benthamites were hostile to poetry, what they were hostile to was all sentimentality, declamation, vague generalities that indicated the absence or the failure of rational arguments. And they seem to have taken the frequent attacks on their own cold calculativeness as something of a badge of honour. Mill freely concedes that many in his circle were in fact great readers of poetry. And he says, this is on the quotation I've given you, the correct statement, as for myself, would be not that I disliked poetry, but that I was theoretically indifferent to it. I disliked any sentiments in poetry which I should have disliked in prose, and that included a great deal. I was wholly blind to its place in human culture as a means of educating the feelings, but I was personally very susceptible to some kinds of it. Okay. So the larger implications of Mill's recognition that this undervaluation of poetry was a limitation, in fact an error on the part of Benthamite rationalism, and his awakening of the power of poetry as an educator of feeling, emerges when he goes on, after the paragraphs on Marmontel, to attempt to connect the individual happiness to the general picture. If the capacity for happiness was to be realized, Mill insists, it couldn't just be by sacrificing the public good to egotistic pursuit of happiness. Personal happiness, but how are they going to be linked? That's the real problem for him. He effectively recognizes the problem when he provides one of the most authoritatively experiential testimonies to the insufficiency of the utilitarian privileging of the greatest happiness. As he puts it most simply in the autobiography, to know that a feeling would make me happy if I had it didn't give me the feeling. And the stress of that disconnection reverberates with that pained ambiguity, I think, make me happy. The approved and achieved Benthamite meaning is give me reasons to be happy. The felt and failed meaning is make me feel so. The disconnection isn't solved just by Mill coming to recognize that having the feeling in one's own right and on one's own behalf matters. If things were going well for Mill in later 1827, if by then he were restored to equanimity, that doesn't mean to say that things were going well for everyone on average, whatever on average could mean, and whoever everyone is. In other words, one can't meaningfully ask whether a society feels happy or unhappy in quite the same way that one can ask this question of individuals. And this seems to me to be a real problem in the way the public talk about the contribution to happiness happens at the moment. Most of us understand the question about happiness directed to ourselves as a psychological question. But you can't ask a psychological question in quite the same way of the group, the aggregate. It's become a secondary interest to me that if you ask a philosopher to discuss this problem, really, it isn't a problem, and it shouldn't have been a problem within utilitarianism. You just do the adding up. But for anybody who wants to think about motive and connection and why we should want to pursue these things, why we should care about them, it is, as it was for Mill, a pretty serious problem indeed. Now, how did Mill deal with it? It's the essence of his crisis that it makes him in some ways acutely alert to the problem of why the individual should care for the greater good. But in others, plenty of people have felt that he wasn't really alert enough to it. So a large number of his critics have held that even in utilitarianism, which was written some 7 years after the passages in the autobiography, he never provided a sufficiently persuasive explanation of how the happiness of individual persons connects to the general happiness. certainly the logical proof he offered in utilitarianism that the general happiness is desirable because the happiness of each individual is so has widely been thought unsatisfactory. So the famous sentence, happiness is a good, each person's happiness is a good to that person, and the general happiness therefore a good to the aggregate of all persons. It's a sentence that seems oddly to have been written by a man who never experienced the crisis detailed in the autobiography and never recognised that each individual's happiness has a different kind of priority for him or her from the general happiness. Treating happiness as a simply additive quality, it pays no regard to motive. But there is a letter written in answer to a question from Henry Jones, a teacher in a private school in Bristol, in which he gives a rather better answer. And as Alan Ryan puts it, if this letter had been more widely known, perhaps there wouldn't have been quite so much debate within philosophy. So he writes to Henry Jones, as to the sentence you quote from my utilitarianism, when I said that the general happiness is a good to the aggregate of all persons, I didn't mean that every human being's happiness is a good to every other human being, though I think in a good state of society and education it would be so. I merely meant in this particular sentence to argue that since A's happiness is a good, B's is a good, C's a good, etc., the sum of all these goods must be a good. If that letter had been more widely known, the critical literature would have been somewhat thinner, as Alan Ryan's summary statement. But he adds, the casual way Mill responded to his critics is itself somewhat dispiriting. Well, possibly, but there's a substantial literature written in full acknowledgement of the explanation that still finds Mill's account incomplete and perhaps incapable of completion. So Roger Crisp, arguing that it is capable of completion, understands that you'd have to fill in a number of assumptions. The moral assumptions that everybody is taking morality seriously, the aggregative assumption that the truths of arithmetic are applicable to the valuation of happiness, and the impartiality assumption that when summing happiness, the distinction between persons is irrelevant. Each of these assumptions can be disputed, and neither separately nor together do they quite preserve Mill from the charge of failing to demonstrate that the individual who naturally cares for his or her own happiness ought also to care for the happiness of everybody. The autobiography, so that's, if you like, the formal difficulty. That's where utilitarianism gets to you. But the autobiography, I think, gets you somewhere else. It offers a different kind of answer to the problem of how to connect them up. Mill moves on from the account of his mental crisis and the start of his rehabilitation through reading Marmontel to offer a summary statement of his revised theory of happiness. The experiences of this period, he reflects, led me to adopt a theory of life very unlike that on which I had before acted, and having much in common with what at that time I certainly had never heard of, the anti-self-consciousness theory of Carlyle. I never indeed wavered in the conviction that happiness is the test of all rules of conduct and the end of life, but I now thought that this end was only to be attained by not making it the direct end. Those only are happy, I thought, this is a sentence John Kay picks up, those only are happy who have their minds fixed on some object other than their own happiness, on the happiness of others or the improvement of mankind, even on some art or pursuit followed not as a means, but as itself an ideal end. Aiming thus at something else, they find happiness by the way. Now, my literary instincts tell me that that sounds terribly like Samuel Johnson, like Rasselas. I can't find something that's exactly like it, but I would hold to the claim that there is a kind of Johnsonian cadence of kind of a relaxed standard, if you like, for happiness going on there. That is suggestively literary in its own way. So the answer he gives in the autobiography is a surprising one. It has something to do, I think, with the fact that this isn't a work of formal philosophy. It doesn't have to meet quite the same standards of formal justification. But it also has something to do with his wanting to give a higher place here to the notion of individual motive and also to liberty of choice. So one of the things it does is to relax the exactingness of the idea that we should all be pursuing the utilitarian goal as our highest goal and to make place for something that includes among its list of things even some art or pursuit. Now, you could quibble over whether that phrasing admits even some art or pursuit on the same basis of everything else, but it is there. And it's not, I think, trying to persuade everyone to agreement that this will be the most valid goal of the life for everybody. Now, as importantly, he asserts, the piece John Kay picks up, that the relation between the individual's happiness and the happiness of society can only be indirect. Those only are happy who have their minds fixed on some object other than their own happiness. It's noteworthy that he doesn't frame it in connection with the Benthamite standard. In fact, at no point in the autobiography does he do that. So again, it's not a formal justification. It's instead an attempt to demonstrate the consequences of his own discovery of something missing in his education for his own life, not least through the series of adjustments made after the narration of the crisis and the first stage of recovery to his account of how how reading literature can contribute to the experience and the theoretical understanding of happiness. Okay, so the first contribution literature makes is really of the moment, and it's that awakening of the lever, if you like, for private feeling on his own part that comes with reading Marmontel. And that is, I think, a pretty passing moment. It's the kind of the fixing of the crisis, but it's not the bit that lasts. Much more importantly, poetry comes to be valued as a mode of apprehension available to everybody in the culture, a way of seeing and describing the world that goes beyond analysis, and if properly incorporated into a culture, will serve to correct any distortive bias towards the analytic. There are problems, I think, with that, and they've been pointed out by many critics. Terry Eagleton is the one that I'll give you in a second. It's a pretty common view of the Mill who wrote the famous pairing of essay portraits, Coleridge and Bentham, that he comes up with a theory of life that can seem as narrowly functionalist as the habit of analysis that he wants to correct and redeem. So you have a kind of pair of scales, something's gone wrong with analysis, so you put feeling back in the other one. You know, something's gone wrong with your economics, so you put literature in the other side of the scales. And there's something painfully, to some minds, analytically sort of narrow or cold or rationalist or just too polarizing about that to be itself a satisfactory model. So Eagleton mocks Mill in ideology and literary form on just that score. His is a mechanistic harnessing of the symbolically fertile, metaphysically coercive resources of romantic humanism to an impoverished empiricist liberalism. Feel that 1970s prose coming. Okay. Now, I'm not going to spend too long defending Mill against it, though it does seem to me a misreading. I think if you're going to take that view of the Coleridge and Bentham essays, it's worth thinking about where they were first published, in the radical journal, the Westminster Review, where Bentham could have expected a much easier ride and Coleridge a much harder one. So he's doing a kind of rebalancing within the terms of the audience he's speaking to. Similarly, I think if you look at the passages of direct literary discussion in the autobiography after the crisis moment, you find something rather subtler than a functional yoking of poetic humanism to calculative analysis, something more complex than the basic awakening of sympathies that you get with the Marmontel episode itself. I'm not going to do the detail on this because I think it probably doesn't carry very well with snippets of quotation from poetry of the kind that he gives you. But the basis of it is that he transfers his sympathies first to Wordsworth, where he finds something that speaks very much to the pleasure that he's had walking in the Lake District and, you know, seeing the landscapes there that take him out of himself. But it's really noticeable that it doesn't take very long indeed before he starts importing critical quibbles with Wordsworth. So Wordsworth's reading of Platonism is just knocked out of court. It's just, you know, it doesn't even get off square one. He quibbles at the level of the sentence. He quibbles mainly with the kind of philosophical underpowering of what's happening there. He then moves on to Coleridge, who appears as the philosopher who gives him the most potent description of despair as he, Mill himself, experienced in a later resurgence of depression. But he's also pretty snippy about Coleridge and says that he thinks decidedly superior the gifts of Mill's friend and one-time Coleridgean disciple, F.D. Morris. So what you get is not a kind of upping of the stakes or a sort of moving terrain, if you like, where the next powerful emoter, the next powerful expressor of feeling gets moved in to do the job at that period in a life that's still devoted mainly to analysis. You get instead something that starts to, as far as you can, incorporate the feeling response with an analytic response that, and this is the really important bit, doesn't disqualify the emotional response that had. So one of the most memorable things for me that he says about Wordsworth is that even though his own tastes moved on, he will never forget and will never cease to value intrinsically, is the word he uses, the quality of Wordsworth for what he gave him at the point in his life when it mattered. In other words, something about remembered need and the remembered occasion of reading poetry also comes in to, if you like, correct or qualify the judgment that's going, the rational judgment that's going on about content. Now, literary critics and intellectual historians rightly look to Romanticism as the proximate source for the high valuation that's placed on literature. There is another, however, I think, literary and philosophical text, ghosting Mill's writing in that crisis scene, and I'm going to use it as a way into talking about the nub of the issues here, really, for the defence of a higher education and the humanities, qualitative pleasures. When Mill declares with relief that he was not a stock or a stone, it seems to me that there must have been running through his mind somewhere, not least because he had translated it, and you can read his translation as part of the collected works now. The passage in the Gorgias where Socrates asks the oligarch Callicles, this is on your second sheet here, Whether it's correct to say, as people do, that those who want nothing are happy. And Callicles, the oligarch, says no, for at that rate, stones and corpses would be extremely happy. Compare Mill, I was not a stock or a stone. The claims for qualitative pleasure come out of, in the first instance, a recognition that simply having one's needs met or one's basic appetites satisfied is not enough, that some pleasures are better than others. So I've collected together the key claims from utilitarianism and put them in one place on your sheet. If we take them in turn, some kinds of pleasure, Mill claims, are more desirable and more valuable than others. Of two pleasures, if there be one to which all or almost all who have experience of both give a decided preference, that is the more desirable pleasure. If one of the two is, by those who are competently acquainted with both, placed so far above the other that they prefer it, even though knowing it to be attended with a greater amount of discontent, and would not resign it for any quantity of the other pleasure which their nature is capable of, we are justified in ascribing to the preferred enjoyment a superiority in quality, so far outweighing quantity as to render it in comparison of small account. Okay, so a small amount of higher pleasures is better than any number of lower pleasures. A being of higher faculties requires more to make him happy, is capable probably of more acute suffering, and is certainly accessible to it at more points than one of an inferior type. But in spite of these liabilities, he can never really wish to sink into what he feels to be a lower grade of existence. And finally, and probably most famously, whoever supposes that this preference takes place at a sacrifice of happiness, that the superior being in anything like equal circumstances is not happier than the inferior, confounds the two very different ideas of happiness and content. It's indisputable that the being whose capacities of enjoyment are low has the greatest chance of having them fully satisfied. And a highly endowed being will always feel that any happiness which he can look for, as the world is constituted, is imperfect. But he can learn to bear its imperfections if they are at all bearable. And they will not make him envy the being who is indeed unconscious of the imperfections, but only because he feels not at all the good which these imperfections qualify. It is better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied. And if the fool or the pig is of a different opinion, it is because they only know their own side of the question. The other party to the comparison knows both sides. Again, a lot of ink spilt on a few paragraphs. For those who react against Mill's account of qualitative pleasures, and plenty of people do, the problems can seem multiple. Which pleasure specifically are we supposed to understand as higher? Or synonym for Mill, nobler, and which ones are we supposed to think are baser? In fact, there's a very funny literature from among the philosophers, which you can find in your own time, in which a case is made for the higher pleasure of the orgasm, or whatever it's going to be, or wine drinking that will fill the space that's clearly intended by Mill to be occupied by something better than that. Is it really possible to make distinctions in qualities of pleasure without importing criteria foreign to hedonism? That's, I think, a logical problem. So, for example, moral criteria, aren't you starting to moralize rather than say something strictly about pleasure? How can we verify that higher pleasures are indeed higher? How can we know competent from incompetent judges? What's required for a person to become competent? Even setting aside the verification questions as unavoidably to be decided by experience, the very tone and manner of Mill's account of qualitative pleasures puts a lot of people off. It has what seems a pretty elitist disdain for the pig and the swinish fool, and its tendency is to make one wonder whether this was, in fact, someone who sufficiently knew both sides of the question. Above all, perhaps most simply, it has some kind of capacity to make happiness sound a pretty flat condition. Now, you don't have to try to solve all the difficulties, I think, with qualitative hedonism in order to isolate the implications it has for his mature thinking about the contribution the humanities can make to a happy life. Mill gave some pretty clear indications, both in utilitarianism and elsewhere, about how we can tell a higher from a lower pleasure. So the primary distinction for him is between bodily and intellectual pleasures, hence the inferiority of the pig in muck. But intellectual pleasures, including aesthetic and moral sentiments, are also internally ranked. So higher pleasures are connected with beauty, with sublimity, with justice, and certain highly impressive and affecting ideas. The next bit, I suspect, is going to have fewer followers. He's taking up Ruskin here, anything which suggests vividly the idea of infinity, for example, or magnitude or power without limit, or which stimulates the active power of the imagination to rise above known reality into a more attractive or a more majestic world. Not surprisingly, Mill doesn't say very much at all, in fact, next to nothing about the other end of the scale, the lower pleasures, but they're by implication any pleasures that fail to meet those higher standards. So one can imagine literature that merely aims at entertainment, for example, or that is content with cliches of style and sentiment, or that follows, or I'm following a suggestion from one of his early reviews, any artistic representation that is merely imitative rather than creative, belonging to the mechanical rather than the fine arts, as he puts it. Mill would have granted, he does grant, in utilitarianism that the value placed on good poetry and other expressions of intellectual culture and refined feeling are going to go unrecognised by people who don't have the education to appreciate them. So for that reason, it's not going to be available as a general aid to happiness, at least not in an imperfectly egalitarian world. That education better equips you to participate in a qualitatively happy life was in fact part of his case for a national reformed education system and for the extension of education to women on equal terms with men, and in rather less patrician tones there than have just been cited. In Mill's ideally reformed world, everybody would be highly endowed by the culture that you're born into and the education that you receive. One of the reasons why Mill liked Plato was that he saw in him a philosopher for whom morals are but a branch of intelligence. No evil is ever done voluntarily, but always involuntarily, from want of knowledge, from ignorance of good or evil. Whoever had knowledge to see what was good would certainly do it. It seems to me there's something of the same perception colouring his account of what a person educated into the use of their higher faculties would then want. He really doesn't think that anybody equipped to participate in the higher pleasures would then ever want, really, to sink down to the lower ones. Now, it's not hard to see that perhaps a better model here might be a mixed economy in which the higher pleasures are available and enjoyed, but one doesn't necessarily have to sneer at the lower ones as well. This is a limitation, and it's no small part, I think, of the interest of the autobiography that in the case of explaining to this to the development of Mill's mind, it repeatedly places itself as an angle to his philosophical views. An account of how you get to your mature views is not the same thing as a formal justification for them. The autobiography's description of the kinds of pleasure Mill himself obtained from literature, in fact, requires one to modify this formal account of how individual happiness relates to general happiness and the standard view of qualitative pleasures. Specifically, it becomes necessary to modify the standard view to allow for the temporal and often uneven development of an intellectual and ethical life. So what he doesn't do in utilitarianism is to give us what we've already had in the autobiography, which is an account of how one's pleasures develop across one's life, that they're temporally situated in according to our psychological needs, but also according to tastes, which are not static, which are not simply adopted at the age of 18, say, and remain there as your tastes, your access, if you like, to your qualitative pleasures, but something that will be, to a very strong degree, circumstantially conditioned, contingent even. Okay, so qualitative pleasures are an important element in the story, but primarily as the endowments of a mature mind, one that has learned to practice or at least to look for a right balance of feeling and analysis. The qualitative response to literature, as we've seen, was not as important to Mill in his early 20s as the basic emotional one. His reading for Marmontel was not indiscriminate. Some discrimination went into the fact that he was responding to Marmontel at all rather than a less eloquent or knowledgeable memoirist. But that wasn't really the point of the narrative. Subsequent stages in his life story, by contrast, describe and increasingly demonstrate the gradual development of his own tastes and aesthetic judgments as a component of the pleasure he took from literature. Marmontel, Wordsworth, Coleridge. He's not describing there a straightforward process of graduation from the dualistic remedial model of engagement with literature to the conjoined feeling analytic model. If nothing else, a strong sense of the claims of memory, the ability to recall what it felt like to be profoundly unhappy and then recover through literature the possibility of happiness, would prevent him, I think, from equating the ethical value of literature only with the achieved higher tastes and judgments. As I said, he goes on valuing Wordsworth not so much for his intrinsic value, which more mature judgment qualifies as by the measure of what he has done for me. Okay, so that's the Mill material that one has to work with if one wants to try to recover from the history of philosophy, an argument that we've already had fairly well developed for us and seem to have forgotten about the contribution that literature especially, but any imaginative component of the humanities can make to happiness. A defense of the humanities by way of what this would strictly be called axiological hedonism can't be a complete defense in the form that Mill gave to that broad terrain, it's got evident attractions, but it also has, I think, pretty inevitable limitations. Let's do the attractions first. The primary attraction is that it offers one of the most powerful personal testimonies we have, and one of the most authoritative intellectual arguments we have for the incompleteness of any analytic culture that isn't tested and extended by constant contact with the culture of expressive feeling. So given where I started you off with the arguments for the humanities that come out of a sense that something is going wrong or becoming unbalanced in the culture of our disciplines, that's no small argument to have on our side. One obvious limitation is the tendency of the argument to resolve, in spite of Mill's efforts at preventing it doing so, I think, into a two cultures dualism that risks misrepresenting the tenor of our intellectual life now and then. On the other hand, I think some of us would say that it isn't always a misrepresentation, that that dualism does actually affect the way we argue repeatedly. So having the one side of it available to us is no bad thing. Mill's concern with a relatively narrow and elite range of cultural tastes isn't a fatal limitation, I think. That's just one of the points at which history has moved on and we can move on with it. He might have conceded that his own understanding of a liberal education ought to admit a broader set of agreements on the objects of culture and the different spheres in which they find value. There is maybe a larger problem, I think, over his account of the reasons for valuing literature other than as the lack of an account of them. Reasons for valuing literature other than as an educator of the feelings. The autobiographies is almost nothing about the pleasures of expressive form, for example, or the practice and recognition of technique, or the value attaching to the thought content, as well as the incitement to feeling in literature, or indeed about the pleasures of reasoning about literature and its effects. One of the things that we do with literature in humanities departments is we reason about it. On the other hand, it's abundantly clear from his intellectual practice and his comments on education throughout his life that the education of the feelings is not the only end of education any more than is the education of analytic reason. They need to be in mixed quantity and mixed quality, in his view of education. And that, I think, is what you're seeing acted out for us, if you like, in the autobiography as the supplementary, the necessary supplementary reading to utilitarianism and the system of logic. There's a strong and growing body of recent writing that I haven't really been talking about today that would encourage an addition to Mill on the relation between emotion and cognition. In other words, that would ask us to see the emotions and the passions as themselves good. Now, one of the reasons I haven't dealt with it here is that I've dealt with it extensively elsewhere, and I'm kind of reluctant to go over the same terrain again. But in summary view, one of the most important contributions to that way of thinking at present is those who subscribe to a cognitive theory of emotions. In other words, who see the emotions as themselves forms of intelligence. The account of the humanities' contribution to happiness that I've been developing here doesn't prohibit that addition or the conclusion that might follow that the humanities make a contribution to happiness that is simultaneously a contribution to knowledge. So it's not just, you could say in addition to Mill, it's not just a contribution to feeling or a corrective to analysis, it does itself represent a kind of knowledge. I myself retain, I just have to say in summary, and I can point you to the material if you want more detail, I do retain a degree of skepticism about the cognitive theory of emotions. And that skepticism seems to me to find some support from reading Mill. A core component in his account of his personal crisis and the recurrence of unhappy periods subsequently is his realization that a feeling about a situation or an object is something more and quite other than an intellectual appraisal of that situation or that object. Most of the cognitive theory of emotions material rides on the claim that when you have a feeling about something, what you're really doing at a deeper level is making an appraisal of it, which is a knowledge appraisal or an intelligent appraisal. You don't have to subscribe to the intelligence of emotions in order to advance the claim that culturally developed sentiments are among the basic human goods, however. And more importantly in this context, that an educated familiarity with the range and depth and variety of human emotions and ways of understanding them constitutes one of the goods of education. Adjusted to a wider range of tastes and a more modern sense of the kinds of cultural materials worth our intellectual attention, Mill's account of qualitative hedonism supplies, moreover, something that the current critical literature on education and happiness is strikingly lacking. Put simply, he tells us that some kinds of pleasure are only available to those who possess sufficient education. A higher level of education brings higher intellectual and aesthetic pleasures with it. It brings them within our grasp when they wouldn't otherwise be there. To say that higher education brings higher pleasures would be glib, on the other hand, because the two meanings of higher are not identical. A higher, more advanced education today is not definitively an education in higher, more sublime intellectual tastes. One can jettison or leave as optional most of Mill's assumptions about what raises a pleasure to a higher order, sublimity, the sense of infinity, nobility, but retain the central perception that a higher level of education brings more complexly valuable kinds of cultural experience within our reach. So I suppose at its simplest, what you can do is relax the criteria of elevation, if you like, and import criteria of complexity or subtlety or difficulty or intellectual graspability instead. All defences are circumstantial. Mill's defence of poetry in the course of a larger reaction against Benthamism's reductive definition of the human good was an argument forged in extremis. It privileges certain questions and certain claims over the others. But then the observation made by his friend Grote remains true. There are wants of our animal nature, the satisfaction of which is happiness in the view of the economist. But human life develops wants and feelings much beyond all this. And here it's as hard to find universally accepted pleasures as it is to find universally accepted notions of duty. Among the strongest reasons for keeping Mill in the frame of contemporary discussion about the value of the humanities is that the problems with utilitarianism that provoked his attention are once again topical. In the two fields that have had the most marked influence on recent political thinking, behavioral economics and positive psychology, Mill is, as I started by telling you, a near total absence. The revisions he made to utilitarianism remain canonical for philosophy, and with different emphases, literary criticism and political history. So I think any theory of human happiness that's going to hold out to us now the possibility of accounting for happiness or offer individual and collective happiness as the goal at which we should be aiming needs reminding that we have been here before.